Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Van Weven. Alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad Microverse Riley.
Hi.
And Spencer Quantum Realm Williams.
I don't know what sound effect that would make, so I'll just say hello.
You don't need a sound. What? Oh, it's because you're on the. Oh, it's because you're on the soundboard again. Is that what you're saying?
It is.
Spencer is owning this soundboard. Y'all don't even know.
God, I hope not. So, we got a great show in store for you. As we're gonna be talking about, of course, Ant-Man and the Wasp. We got to get a chance to see it in a press screening, and we are looking forward to talking about it. So, before we do, Chad, give us a little bit of that info.
I sure will. You don't need an ankle monitor to keep tabs on us. The Filmlosophers podcast is always presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live at VGB Studios. Big or small, no streaming platform is too much or too little for us. New episodes debut each Wednesday on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom.
That is a lot of places.
When you're ready for a little quantum entanglement... We're talking about that. Topics here. Topics, people. Connect
Ooh,
with us on
Facebook.
I was going to say, that seemed a little...
This episode is rated PG-13.
Connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers or follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Finally, if you find yourself stranded at the subatomic level of reality, you'll probably have enough time to listen to all of our previous episodes. Not that you have anything else of immediate concern down there.
Hashtag subatomic Saturdays.
Are we still talking about quantum entanglement?
Access our amazing library of content on our website, filmlosophers.com.
That's right. We got a website.
Website!
Man, you're dirty, Spence. Okay, we're going to... Speaking of subatomic particles and everything else
in
between.
I don't want to talk about particles anymore.
We're going to jump right into the review. So we got a chance to check out Ant-Man and the Wasp, the film that doesn't debut until this Friday. We got a great opportunity to see the film, screen it, and we all had a great time. It was actually a really good
film. It's
pretty
fun. I mean, we're not going to spoil too much for you in this review, but there was a lot to enjoy.
Spencer, is there a sound effect for non-spoiler review?
I don't have that ready. I need time. how about...
There was time now.
This one. Non-spoiler!
That was a reverse explosion.
Well, we're just going to keep moving forward. Chad, why don't you give us that official synopsis?
I would love to. In the aftermath of Captain America Civil War, Scott Lang, played by Paul Rudd, grapples with the consequences of his choices as both a superhero and a father. As he struggles to rebalance his home life with his responsibilities as Ant-Man, he's confronted by Hope Van Dyne, played by Evangeline Lilly, and Dr. Hank Pym, played by Michael Douglas, with an urgent new mission. Scott must once again put on the suit and learn to fight alongside the Wasp as the team works together to uncover secrets from their past.
That's right. Directed by Peyton Reed, the film stars Paul Rudd, Evangeline Lilly, Michael Peña, Walton Goggins, Bobby Cannavale, Judy Greer, Tip T.I. Harris, Randall Park, Michelle Pfeiffer, Lawrence Fishburne, and Michael Douglas, as well as several others.
It's like just an unending scroll of famous people
in
this movie.
It's totally true. And I think, you know what? For some reason, my notes didn't have...
Hannah John Kamen.
I was like, I'm missing one person.
I got your back, brother.
Thank you. This will be the 20th film to be released by Marvel Studios for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So we are in film 20 of, like, this entire franchise. This is
10 years, 20 movies.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty extraordinary.
Well, I think it's... just to kind of mention it, I think it's really cool for the fact that all three of us have been kind of at the genesis of this franchise. and we are 20 films into it, like you said, 10 years into it as well. And it's just, it's really cool to see the direction and the lengths that they're willing to take some of these stories to continue this franchise and keep bringing something new. And this being a fine example of just that.
I mean, honestly, when you look at the source material for Ant-Man, the MCU version of Ant-Man and many of the characters is totally new. This is not the way these characters show up in the comics. It's a different combination in terms of the Wasp. The original Wasp in the Avengers was Janet Van Dyne, not Hope Van Dyne.
Yeah.
In terms of who you would see as the origin character per se. So there's quite a bit that's different. Scott Lang was not the originally introduced Ant-Man. Hank Pym was back in the 60s, with the Avengers. And so there's just quite a lot of richness in seeing familiar names and power sets, but in a completely different context than they debuted in the comics. It changes quite a bit, especially, we'll get into it later, but especially with regard to Michelle Pfeiffer's character.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things where looking back, in terms of the franchise as a whole, I think it's really important to recognize needing to update, and not so much update, but to adapt, I guess is a better word.
That's a great comment.
To adapt the source material for what these films are trying to do and continue to do, because honestly, if it was an exact replica of what we had read in the comics growing up, I think there would have been kind of that fed up almost mentality of like, okay, this is great and all, but let me see something, you know, new and bring something great to the silver screen. And I think that's one of the things that this franchise has done year after year after year, where they bring in another, you know, element to the story and they amp it up to 11 and they bring us something that we haven't seen. Great case in point, the Black Panther film was an incredible origin story, as well as an incredible first installment to that particular character's whole storyline.
Definitely, yeah. Well, and here, I mean, you've got, in a way, I mean, yeah, you've got the continuation of Ant-Man from, you know, the first Ant-Man film, but you've also got the evolution and development of the Wasp as her own, like, as a superhero in her own right, which you always knew in Ant-Man, like, the potential was there. She knew a lot more than Scott did about how to use the technology, how to fight, anything and everything. She just had that tension with her father, Hank Pym. And now you've got kind of those reins have been loosened since you saw the suit at the end of Ant-Man, the Wasp suit. And now she's putting it to use.
This film actually replaced Marvel's Captain Marvel, which is set to debut in 2019 in the July 6, 2018 release date. This was originally marked by Marvel Studios years ago when they first announced that they were going to be making the sequel to Ant-Man and the Wasp, obviously. The decision actually came down to really a lot of people's surprise, because everybody was hoping that immediately after the first half of that Infinity War two-parter, so to speak, that we were going to get the formal introduction of Captain Marvel to help bridge that gap for the second half at the time of Infinity War. Now that that's been pushed back to 2019, when exactly does anybody know when the next Avengers film is?
It should be in May of 2019.
So it's actually going to come out before Captain Marvel?
No, it should come out afterwards.
No, Captain Marvel is March, isn't it?
That's right.
I believe Captain Marvel is March because you do need to be introduced to her before she comes in and cleans house.
Okay, so the official schedule is Captain Marvel is March 8th, 2019, and the next Avengers movie is May 3rd, 2019.
Well, there you go.
Cannot come soon enough.
So, as we said, we got a chance to screen the film. We were really excited. It was going to be in... Well, okay, let's take a step back for a quick second, because the film was in 3D.
Oh, gosh.
Spencer had this entire conversation as to why he feels there is no purpose to having anything 3D in any movie from here on out. Ever since Avatar, apparently he's been ruined by Avatar, that he cannot appreciate, nor does he care to see any kind of 3D in any film here on out. So if there's any filmmakers out there or movie studios, Spencer has something to say to you.
Okay, first off, like, Avatar did something interesting with their 3D effects. They made it, like, immersive. It felt like that world was around you. I haven't seen anything like that since.
His hands are shaking, people. You're not, you
I'm
don't understand.
I'm gestating with my hands.
Don't you mean gesturing?
PG-13.
Yeah, but, like, I haven't seen anything interesting done with 3D technology. It's, like, just kind of the same stupid, like, oh, my hand is coming out at you from the screen. Like, I don't want to pay $5 extra for that. I just don't.
Is there an actual movie where that happened? Like, somebody's saying, my hand is coming out of the screen.
You know, legitimately, though, Ant-Man had a small role in Captain America Civil War, mm-hmm. and he became Giant Man, and he did reach out towards you to grab War Machine. So, mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, this character specifically did reach his hand out towards you. I thought it was a fun effect in that film.
I didn't see it in 3D.
Oh, I see.
So you're saying then that you have yet to experience all the films that offer the 3D option, and you're just basing your entire decision on just how great Avatar was.
No, I will
agree on the Avatar front, mm-hmm. because everyone kind of assumed that it was going to be that jump out at you kind of 3D tech. And as soon as you were sitting in the theater with the glasses on and it starts, you're thinking, wait a minute, this is not what I thought it was. It's like deep. There's
depth.
It's 3D going back instead of coming forward, which did create a very immersive film environment to kind of get lost in.
Yeah.
And people did, and they got depressed when they couldn't go to Pandora anymore.
Yeah, where's that at, James Cameron?
Apparently he's been on some foreign planet making the next few, I don't know.
I know, they keep adding additional films, but like nothing happens with the next one.
That's like, we promise we're going to make it, but we're also making 7 more, and people get excited.
I mean, honestly, poor Sam Worthington and Zoe Saldana are going to be like in mocap suits with canes. Wow. Like trying to re-embody these characters.
That is scary. But terrible. Coming back down to Earth, talking about, because, you know, no longer being in the sky with James Cameron, talking about Ant-Man and the Wasp. Like I said, we got a chance to see it. Kind of going around the table, let's go ahead and start with those expectations. What were some of your guys' expectations coming into the film? And actually, you know what? I'll start because I probably have the shortest to say.
Do it.
I wasn't expecting a lot of good.
And why is that?
Because I cannot stand Paul Rudd.
Indeed.
I don't like him. I don't like his acting. I'm pretty sure aside from acting, he's a great guy. But I just don't like his humor. I don't like his movies. I don't like his roles. Like being introduced to him with his weird roles on Friends, the TV show. And then his Judd Apatow appearances with Knocked Up, 40-Year-Old Virgin, and then This Is 40. I just didn't like that whole... I didn't like his humor. I'm just not a fan. It always seems like Paul Rudd plays the side man. He doesn't seem like he's capable of playing the lead man. And I'm not going to lie, I wasn't a huge fan of Ant-Man and the first Ant-Man, the first film in this too, because I didn't like him and there was just too much of him. Like, I know he's the main character. I know he's the main character, but I just didn't. I didn't like seeing him that much. I don't know. I just he's very off putting to me.
You know, I have a very similar thing with Nicolas Cage.
That is true.
Now my reasons are different.
I can't watch him.
Because of his quote-unquote acting style, which I don't think is acting. I think it's just like kind of having a mental breakdown in front of the camera all the time. Everything. I don't want to badmouth the man. Maybe he's a wonderful, charming person in real life, but on the screen, I just can't watch him.
But
there's
Chad,
just
he was in a Left Behind movie.
I know, and I saw the Left Behind movie, and everything else about the movie was better. and there was not a lot of good in that movie. It wasn't very well done, in my opinion. But anyway, so I have a similar hang up, I guess is what I'm saying. I don't have that hang up about Paul Rudd. I happen to enjoy Paul Rudd in most of what I've seen him in, at least. I haven't seen his entire filmography, but I do have that hang up with somebody else, and his name is Nicolas Cage.
It's
and
true.
I have not seen the Ghost Rider films.
Now,
and I won't.
The why thing, would you?
Exactly.
The thing is this, though. I don't think I or anybody else in the history of anybody who knows cinema could ever despise a particular individual's performances more so than how much you despise this man.
The like, only time I enjoyed Nicolas Cage, I'll tell you what it is. The only time I enjoyed Nicolas Cage was when Abed was doing Nicolas Cage in Community. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
That was genius. Genius. And it wasn't actually Nicolas Cage. It was somebody embodying his crazy. So that was the one and only time. Abed on Community was the only time I've ever enjoyed Nicolas Cage.
I'm very touched and humbled and honored that you would compare your loathing of Nicolas Cage to my loathing of Paul Rudd. I don't think I don't like him that
no,
much.
No, yours is not to the level of mine.
Because
I
there
was
are,
trying to relate, but really you're right. We're nothing alike.
Chad will will be watching YouTube, and Chad will literally get up and leave the
I
room.
I will leave the room.
If there is anything with Nicolas Cage
okay,
on.
Then I have to ask you this question that has nothing to do with the movie we're talking about.
Okay, good.
What?
I prefer to get off topic.
What?
He's coming back to Nicolas Cage. I hope you know that.
Yeah. What do you think of Face Off?
Oh my gosh.
That movie's amazing.
John Travolta and Nicolas
Cage.
They're
both being ridiculous.
They're both like in
both
their
of them.
Psychotic breakdown stages.
Before you can even spell your name, that guy, that John Travolta.
That's, yeah.
Shall I answer the question that has been posed to me? If Face Off as like a DVD in its packaging could be crumpled as easily as paper, say like chewing gum wrapper, I would do it 1,000 times over because I'm also not overly fond of John Travolta. So it's like a double whammy.
This movie is like the holy grail of
it's
loathing for
so bad. Although I will say there's a really fun amusement park ride at Paramount's Kings Island in Ohio, which is near where I grew up in Indiana. So it's called Face Off because you face each other and it goes one way and then goes backwards the other way. So the ride was really fun. The movie is a piece of garbage in my opinion.
Interesting.
Well,
I didn't know there was a ride.
Control Alt Delete. That's what I would do
to Nicolas Cage. Okay. Well,
Ant-Man and the Wasp. Expectations going in. So you're not
a fan of
Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd. Nah, I don't know.
Of Raul Pud. I was.
You got me talking about Nicolas. I got myself talking about Nicolas Cage. So now I'm done. I'm toast.
So I'm not a fan of it. To kind of bring it back around, I'm not a fan of his. I didn't really enjoy the first film all that much as everybody else did. And my expectations were I wasn't too sure how much I was going to enjoy this film, particularly because of the fact of how much they had him in the last one.
Because he's the main character.
Because he's the main character.
Because of how much they had that guy in that movie.
It was like, oh my God.
Can he be in this movie less?
He can. And we
now,
just.
How did you feel about him in Civil War? Was that like an acceptable
amount
of Paul
Rudd? That was an acceptable amount of Paul Rudd. I could handle it. I could stomach it because of the fact that it wasn't so much of him. I think it's just the way his humor comes off, the way he talks. Like, it's minimal. And there was more of him, like, doing action sequences than him actually.
Okay.
Acting.
Here's my last off-topic question. So, who do you despise more, Paul Rudd or T.J. Miller?
Oh, that's a good one for you. That's a good one for you.
I'm broken. Error 404 not found.
I heard a commercial on the radio the other day that was clearly T.J. Miller doing the voiceover, and I thought of you, and I hoped that you were not listening to the same radio station.
I can stomach seeing Paul Rudd in certain films and will even choose to see some of them with him in it as long as he's not the main character. I just don't like any movie that has a lot of T.J. Miller, even if he's just a side character. Like, he was probably the worst thing about Ready Player One, and I adored Ready Player One. But the fact that his voice came through, he was I-Rock in Ready Player One.
Oh, right! He was spacing on him.
He was he was the worst part. Anyway, so we're moving forward, Spencer.
Clearly, we had great expectations of this movie because we're talking about everything else.
Spencer, what about you?
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you guys. I was like, okay, like, Marvel has had some, like, really great hits, like, leading up to this movie. You've got Black Panther, you got Infinity War. So I'm like, okay, like, I feel like this will be an improvement over the first movie, because that'd be super weird if they learned nothing in the past 3 years. So that's how I was feeling. And then after watching this movie, I was like, is the first movie as bad as I think it is? Because, like, I felt pretty good about this movie, so I went back and watched it today, and it's a lot better than I remember it being. But I'm starting to think, now that you're talking about Paul Rudd, I think he was my problem with this movie initially, too. Because,
thank
like,
you.
I yes. feel like I initially went, yes. Paul Rudd, they got this guy? And so
that's true. Most of the world did that.
Yeah. And so I think it was that initial, ooh, it's Paul Rudd, that, like, might have knocked down the first Ant-Man for me. But, like, after I got used to the idea of him being Ant-Man, it's not as bad as I remember.
The other thing that you've got to really respect is the way that they construct each of these non-tentpole parts of the franchise. They make them their own type of story. So, like, in this case, I think a big part of the reason why they went with the dynamics that they did, Hank Pym, Hope Van Dyne, Scott Lang, Cassie Lang, is this whole parent-child relationship thing, which we've seen a little bit of now in Guardians Volume 2 especially. Mm-hmm. But Ant-Man, the original one, came out before Guardians Volume 2. So that whole family dynamic, that more relatable ground level normal guy who puts on a suit, and quite frankly, relatively normal woman putting on a suit. I mean, Hope clearly has honed her skills in various different ways. She's wanted this for a long time. And thought that she was the heir apparent, you know, even in the first film, and had a problem when that wasn't what happened. But, you know, there's definitely a more, like, guy next door feeling about Paul Rudd that really, really fits in the groove of what they're trying to make this mini franchise all about, which is he's a normal guy. He's a flawed normal guy who's made mistakes and wants to make them right, especially for his daughter. You see that in the first film. You see that again here very strongly. I would say expectations-wise, the only thing that was off-putting to me leading up to this movie, and this is going to sound weird, was the Hello Kitty Pez dispenser. In seeing the trailer for the film, when they throw the Pez dispenser out the back of the van and then make it grow huge so that the motorcycle person who's chasing them falls off his bike or her bike or whatever, I just was like, it feels so gimmicky.
Okay.
The first film, I had some issues with how much they used the ants, which you've got to. He's Ant-Man, and Hank Pym, at least, communicates very well through ants. It's weird. It's an odd dynamic. I didn't like all the ants in the first one. I was hoping there were fewer ants in this one. But then when I saw the Pez dispenser, I was thinking, well, I don't want that either. I was really uncertain going into the film. My concern was, how much is it going to really try to hone in on the sincerity of the heart of the story versus the gimmicky opportunities of Pym particles, you know, making things grow or shrink, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
Clearly they were going to do more with it, because they had, even in the trailers, they have the van growing and shrinking and the Pez dispenser and the salt shaker and, you know, whatever. So you see elements, but I was a little concerned going into the film, how much are they going to stay just authentic, genuine, true to the characters versus using the, I guess you could say, the power sets, the technology, to do gimmicky things the whole time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure.
No, completely. And I think that uncertainty really does pay off once you actually see the film, because I think we all can agree the film is actually quite fun. It actually has a really great heart to it. It really does. You know, I'm not too sure, and I'm pretty sure as we dialogue about it, we'll figure it out, but I'm not too sure what makes this film much more enjoyable for me, but I did enjoy this one much more so.
I'll tell you what
it
is. We just saw Infinity War 2 months ago. That's what it is.
Ah, well.
Just needed some sunshine in there.
Yeah,
you needed to bring a little bit of joy.
Everybody needs a smile. Thank you, Michael Pena.
True. So obviously, with the sequels for this film, you see a lot of your old cast members that you saw from the first film. You see them come back. Obviously, Paul Rudd, Evangeline Lilly, Michael Douglas. One of the outstanding parts for me, like Chad just mentioned, Michael Pena. Michael Pena really does shine a lot more in this film. I really did like the idea of him actually utilizing a lot more of the way his brain works to help. Not so much as just to give exposition, but to actually be a part of like some of the problem-solving aspects.
Yeah, I mean, he has a fairly prominent role, especially when mm-hmm. you get into the climax of the story. I mean, he's in it. He's there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a great sequence in the film with him. I don't know if either of you have seen Shrek 2.
Yeah, at some point.
It's been a while.
Well, so this is kind of what immediately came to mind when I was watching it last night when we were seeing it. There's a scene in Shrek 2 where Pinocchio, obviously, when he lies, his nose grows.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be part 3. Either way.
No, it's in 2.
Is it in 2?
I mean, it's just generally true of Pinocchio, but...
That is true. Yeah.
This is true.
His nose grows. And so, like, there's a scene in one of the films where he's being interrogated and he's being told, you know, he's being asked questions. And if he lies, his nose is going to grow and they'll know. So he does this like long around like scenic route to get to the point. And that reminded me a lot of what Michael Pena does in one of the particular scenes that is truly outstanding for me. That was probably like my favorite scene. One of, if not the favorite scene
for me.
Well,
one of the things that's really great is that it's a surprise. And that's part of the reason why we're not doing spoilers.
Yes.
Why we don't do spoilers, generally speaking, because we don't want to ruin some of the surprising, you know, delightful moments or even the shocking ones. I mean, we don't want to ruin it for you. But yeah, there is a really delightful sequence that pretty specifically centers on Michael Pena's character.
I do have to admit, like, if there was one thing I was worried about in this movie, it was would be an over-reliance on Michael Pena and his storytelling ability.
Yeah.
I think that was kind of the best parts of, like, the first one. And usually, you know, some people have a tendency of, like, well, that worked really well here. Let's just do it every 5 minutes.
Let's use it all the time.
But that's not what happens here, which was great.
Which I have to agree. That does pose one of the micro worries, I guess, if you could say, not to, you know, no pun intended. But one of the smaller worries that I had was that recognizing Michael Pena as one of the key staples that made the first Ant-Man enjoyable to some.
Wow. Okay.
Like Spence said, them creating an over-reliance on his humor carrying some of those weaker parts of the film. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about this film is that his role evolves from the last time we saw him to where he's at currently in this film and throughout the film as well. His character evolves, his ability to translate stories, his ability to tell stories, and even his ability to just process out and respond to people. It's
well, and I think a lot of it is just choosing a route that makes sense. So often, I think, Spencer, with what you're talking about is the studio heads or whatever, the creative powers that be, they'll look at something and they'll say, well, this didn't work about it, and this did work about it. So in the sequel, we're going to overly amp up the stuff that did work and overly diminish the stuff that didn't work. And then the sequel ends up horribly unbalanced because you've got too much of the good stuff, too little of the bad stuff, and it just doesn't work. It's a mess. So one of the things that they've admirably done here is, I would say, not to get too far ahead of myself, but there are definitely things about this film. Even while I was watching it, I was thinking, this doesn't work. Why did you weigh down the story with all of this other stuff? Because it kind of distracts from the main point of your narrative. And we'll get into that in a minute. But then there's other stuff like Michael Pena that easily could have been overdone that wasn't. And so that part remains balanced. As far as I'm concerned, in some areas there is balance in the Force.
Wow. Of course, we see a lot of other individuals who were a part of the first film, such as T.I. Harris, rapper. I think he's a rapper.
Yep.
As well as the other individual that's with him. I don't remember his name, but he was in the first film as well. We get Judy Greer, which, oddly enough, I do not remember at all in the first film. I don't know if she was. Or...
What was the best was when they just showed up and, like, you know, there was an expectation that you knew who these characters were. Yes. And I was like, it's like real life when someone sees me and they're like, oh, hi, Spencer. And I'm like, I don't remember you, but I have to pretend like I do.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a scene very, very early on where Judy Greer and Bobby Cannavale show up, and it's just assumed that you know exactly who they are.
Yeah.
Now, to Marvel's credit, they were in the first Ant-Man.
A lot.
Quite a bit, and you should know who they are. But if you haven't watched it recently... you're going to be scratching your head like, wait, who are these people? Oh,
I'm like,
okay.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember them, but I can see the relationship that they have with the characters that I do remember.
But yeah. To be fair to us, there have been 7 movies in between this one and the last time they showed up.
Thank you.
That's,
wow.
That's
a great
lot
point.
Of stuff to remember. Because, like, especially like in the opening parts of this movie, like when people are talking, people are talking to...
Scott. Paul Rudd's character,
yeah.
Scott. Yeah.
They're talking to Scott about like what you did in Germany. I'm like, what happened in Germany? I don't remember. And I'm like, oh, Civil War. Like, we have to go that far back?
What you did in Germany? Yeah, you grew huge and fell into a plane.
Like, that was such a long time ago, and so much has happened since that it's so weird to have to go backtracking slightly to catch them up to where we are now.
Not to mention the fact that, I don't know if this was true for you guys, but like basically from the moment that the movie started, all I cared about knowing was, do they get dusted? Like, the,
oh my
the
gosh.
Only thing I could think about most of the film was, are we going to get an answer to the question that we've had ever since watching Infinity War and not getting an answer there?
Is that why you had a tear coming down when they were showing his daughter? Like, oh my God, she's going to get dusted.
Oh my gosh, I had all the feels. I didn't have a tear. You're making that part up. Cassie Lang, who, yeah. by the way, in the comics universe, does grow up to become a superhero of
Stitcher.
Her own right. So, sneak peek. Like,
what's her name?
15 years from now or whatever. Yeah, Stature is Cassie Lang's superhero name. Mm-hmm. And... So just knowing, I mean, she's a legacy character already built into the franchise, which is awesome. But also she has a lot more screen time and she's really important to Scott Lang's character arc, Paul Rudd's character's arc in this film. And so I definitely was concerned by the time, I mean, it's not a super spoiler to say you will get an answer to your question before the credits are finished rolling. You will get an answer to your question. But at building up to that, knowing like, oh gosh, they are going to answer the question. I've really bonded with these people. I don't know if I'm ready for the answer to this question anymore. But it was wow. so distracting to me. And quite frankly, that what I was mentioning a moment ago about having moments in this story where I'm like, man, this is really just like weighing your narrative down. Like you've got too many story threads in here. And I do think that, I do personally think that's true. I was reviewing it in my mind a lot today, prepping to do this episode. Mm-hmm. I do think that's true. I think there are too many things going on. They could have cut a whole story thread and been better. But at the same time, I think it was too many things to me because Infinity War was a thread of its own also.
Yeah.
That I was trying to track. That what isn't actually really an authentic part of this story until, you know, the mid credits.
Yeah, see, because like going into this movie for me, like I wasn't sure what they were gonna do with like the Infinity War question because I was like, are we gonna get like halfway through the movie and then just like half the characters disappear out of the movie?
Right,
because that would have been amazing if they just chopped off half the characters.
Where you're like, what? Yeah.
So I was like, I just don't know how to, like, it was weird just having like this question that nobody in the movie knew about and like when it was going to fall and when it was going to happen.
Absolutely.
And how it was going to affect everyone.
That's the thing. That's the trippy thing is that none of the characters know that it's going to happen, but the audience is just like, you're just sitting there wondering like, okay, I know it's coming. Just get it over with. Well, Rip off the Band-Aid.
The best part was like, when it did happen, is this woman in front of us was saying, too soon! Too soon! Repeatedly.
Oh my God.
When something allegedly may have happened. When the question is answered.
May or may not have been answered.
Spencer.
And it's true. I think with this particular film, because obviously the first film is set to lay the groundwork for this particular character. You're introduced, obviously, to Scott Lang, who Hank Pym is, who Hope, his daughter, is, what happened with his wife, and all this, Hank's wife. All that.
Janet.
No, yeah, Janet Van Dyne. And you're establishing a lot of that in the first film. In this one, I feel like they're going to... No.
Oh, yeah?
No,
get
I felt...
a little scotch in you.
I felt like this film had a little bit more breathing room in it. Like,
absolutely, yeah.
This film allowed a lot of the characters to kind of flourish a bit and to actually, you know, come into their character and allow that to be, you know, something that they could truly embody in future Marvel films. Case in point, like you were mentioning a little bit ago, Cassie, the girl who plays Scott Lang's daughter.
Well, Cassie is the daughter, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But the girl who plays her.
Yes.
I don't remember as much of her other than, you know, oh, you know, where are you at, Dad? Why are you always in jail? Blah, blah, blah. In the first film, whereas opposed to in this one, it feels like she's as much a part of the solution and victory of this film as much as anybody else.
Yeah.
Because of the things that she's a part of and the things that she contributes to. And I love that because of the fact that I honestly would have written her off as, oh, she's just somebody's daughter. Like, I have no clue about what's going on with Hawkeye, but I don't think their kids are important at all. Man. I don't remember anything.
That's an answer that I don't want to see.
Ooh. See, this question just looms over everything.
Everything.
That's why it's so weird that we're having, like, movies in between these two Infinity War.
It's really trippy. Because it's a lot more trippy than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it's weird.
Why? Because you know what's going to happen, so you can't...
there's just this hanging question that's just looming over everything that you do. And it's like, oh, the hero's making progress, but are they really? Because the question will come, and then something will happen.
Well, snap. I can tell you've been thinking about this for some time.
Yeah, I have.
Well, back to our rainbows.
I was
going to
say, I love how we're like halfway through this episode or better and still haven't really talked about the movie.
Aside from them, obviously, like we said, you get a chance to see, you revisit with Michael Douglas and Hope Van Dyne, and you're reintroduced to this journey that they're going to embark on in trying to find their mother, Hope Van Dyne, who is stuck in the quantum realm.
His wife. Mother.
yeah,
it's not that trippy.
No.
I mean, comic book movies, you never know, but no.
In the interim of them trying to figure this out, we are also introduced to Lawrence Fishburne's character. I'm not too sure of his name, but I know of his...
Bill Foster, right?
Bill Foster, yeah, that's right.
Goliath.
Who ultimately plays...
In comics, he's Goliath. And he makes a reference in this film to a time in the past when he did... work with Hank Pym and use Pym particles to change size.
Yeah. So you're introduced to Lawrence Fishburne's character. One of the standouts for me, which one of the things that Marvel has always had an issue with is their ability to create memorable and just insightful villains who have more than just nefarious thoughts on their mind, like, oh, I'm going to destroy and just destroy everything. There's an issue with that for Marvel. It's like a sickness. They have yet to continue any one particular villain's storyline because it seems like nobody really cares after the fact once they're shown. Obviously, that was broken with Thanos because he's kind of been the underhand of the entire issue.
Right, but they did a lot of work to give him a very full, well-rounded story once you finally started learning his motivation. He wasn't just, I want to destroy. That wasn't what it was about for him.
No, and giving more context and more subtext, I guess, to the particular character, it made him more, as odd as it sounds, more likable or more just attractive as a villain, as an antagonist in the story. And I think that was one of the things that this film really does well in terms of villains with Hannah John Kamen's Ghost character.
Absolutely, yeah.
I honestly felt for her. At some points in time in during the film, I felt like I was quietly rooting for her because you come to find out that she's going through something and she's trying to find a solution to something that happened long ago that was out of her power, and she is trying to figure it out, even if it means sometimes doing the wrong thing.
Well, and here's the thing that's really brilliant about what they did here. This was not the thread that I thought was too much, by the way. Mm. I thought that they could have done a lot more here, and because they had too much going on, they didn't spend enough time with her. Because, again, you've got the parent-child dynamic. The best stories in history, just generally speaking, you have this sense of parallelism, what's called the foil. So you've got a protagonist and an antagonist, and they're essentially two sides of the same coin. Now, in more developed stories, in like modern times, we're kind of used to it. So you want to sort of vary it up. So you've got, let's say in this case, you've got Scott Lang and Cassie Lang, father and daughter. You've got Hank Pym and Hope Van Dyne, father and daughter. And now you've got Bill Foster and this character, Ava, who are not father and daughter, but there's a dynamic there that is meant to serve as a foil to the other. It's not a single character versus character. It's a dynamic versus dynamic thing.
Yeah.
And between all of them kind of working in concert, you get a very big, nuanced image of what it's like to relate to your parents, relate to your children. How does that dynamic work? And you've got all the superheroics, the size changing and the phase shifting and the whatever, you know, the fun CGI kind of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I think personally, I would have loved to have seen more of Ghost, and gotten more of not only her kind of motivation stuff. That's pretty well established, but her arc, her journey, her struggle to not be what she is, but like she's running out of time for something, and she has to solve, like you said, she has to solve this question, this problem. She doesn't have time to do anything other than what she's doing. She's kind of set because of circumstance on a certain path, and that is a really nicely nuanced approach to a villain with special abilities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, completely.
And I should say an antagonist with special abilities, because she is very, very, ultimately you do sympathize tremendously with her.
Yeah.
In ways that they've rarely been able to pull off with other quote unquote villains in the other movies. She's incredibly sympathetic.
Oh, completely, 100%.
Once you learn why she's doing what she's doing.
Yeah. And I think this is one of those instances where Marvel's going to have to pay close attention, because let's just be honest, out of all the villains that they've had, and they've had quite a few, we're talking 20 films, I want to say at least every single one of them had a antagonist in it. I don't think there's been one particular one where there hasn't been an opposing force.
Sure.
And I mean, right off the top of our heads, I think we can only really draw up maybe three or four of them that actually stood out, maybe including this one, you know, from obviously Loki, Thanos, Killmonger, and now Ghost.
Vulture. I would say Vulture from Spider-Man.
True. You don't believe?
No, I agree with that. I was just remembering the reveal of Vulture from Spider-Man. It's just like, that was pretty good.
Yeah, that was really, really well done.
I didn't see that coming, sorry.
Oh, I'm Batman. No, but I think this is one of those things where, you know, Marvel has to pay close attention because of the fact that they need to keep that going. They need to continue to create those antagonists because this is kind of one of those sticking points for a lot of individuals who are either anti-Marvel or just anti-comic book movies. They think the bread is more, or the money is more in the superheroes and not so much of the antagonist or the villains. And I don't think that's true. I think Marvel has tons of great villains that they could pull from. Much like DC. DC is another one of those where you can pull from so many different great characters. They just choose not to. But Marvel has such a deep well of great and dynamic characters, both superhero and villain.
You know, as with so many things, it's not so much a question, a concern of the who as it is of the how.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they've got plenty of who characters. They've even got characters that shouldn't have debuted yet that are doing interesting things. Like,
yeah.
Mantis.
That's what, true.
Like, of all the characters in the Marvel Comics, like, stable, you introduced Mantis brilliantly. Like, yeah. So enjoyable as a character, but like, where are some of the other like major heavy hitters?
Yeah.
Of the comics, they haven't appeared yet. When you introduced Mantis, you hadn't yet fully met Black Panther of all characters, like who has been around for most of the time.
Yeah.
You know, there are quite a few others that we're not going to go into, but you know, the pattern of the rollout, who they use. Is going to be more or less effective simply based on how they use them.
Yeah. And like you said, it's true. They have the who's. And I just think it's just been a constant miss on just executing, creating these great villains in these Marvel films because, I mean, you had Malekith, who could have been great, but it was just Garbo in Thor 2, A Dark World.
It's a legitimate comment, yeah.
I mean, of all people, Baron Zemo should have been one of those heavy hitters that could have actually gone somewhere from Civil War. And
well, he's still alive. He still could.
Yeah, more or less. Baron Von Strucker, that was gone in a hot second.
Yeah, that was a disappointment.
And to the benefit of our good old buddy Omar, obviously, what's his name?
Crossbones.
Yeah, they got rid of him.
Gone before his time.
Yeah. But I say all that to say, let's hope that they continue that particular formula or whatever they're doing, whatever Peyton Reed, who's the director of this film, if they need to tap into him and figure that out or whatnot. Because, I mean, I don't know if Peyton Reed is actually the true golden boy of this because of the fact that the last film that he did, that guy was totally forgettable. Whoever, what was he? The Yellow Jacket?
Yeah, that's right.
That guy?
Oh,
was,
yeah.
That, see? Jacket, yeah. Just,
no, like, seriously.
I wasn't tracking with you for some reason, but yeah.
When, like, I was watching the first Ant-Man earlier today, when they revealed the villain, I was like, wait, that guy was a villain the whole time?
Yeah.
Like, I forgot that, like, that was his face.
He's bald. That's all face. What are you talking about?
Wow.
Sorry,
Corey Stoll.
True. Corey Stoll. That's who it was. But I, like I said, let's hope that that's something that he can continue. But that's one of the things that makes also this film so unique. It's not just a simple, oh, bad guy, good guy, need to stop the bad guy, end of film. It's there's a sense of an ebb and flow for this particular film in terms of the structure and in terms of how this film is formulated. I almost want to say it's in like a simplistic form, like just the way it works.
Yeah, it's a super simple flow.
Yeah, it's almost got
it's straightforward. It's very straightforward.
Exactly. Like I would almost say it's like a typical like family film. Like it seems more of a Disney film than it does as a Marvel film.
Oh, now you've opened a can.
In terms of just the ability to,
I'm not disputing that.
It's what I was thinking. I'm like, I'm watching this and I'm like, I'm really getting some like Disney, you know, live action film vibes off of this, like Homeward Bound or, you know, stuff like that. Like, well, because it was in San Francisco, so that's why I was thinking.
Here's my and I'm finally going to tiptoe around without spoiling things.
Uh-huh.
This is my issue with the film.
Oh,
because it pertains to the conversation of villainy.
Mm.
And one of the things that was really well done about this film was, again, the antagonist, let's say villain, of Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really well handled. However, I do agree a bit of the Disney effect might have been here, because if you're going to allow the audience in a family-friendly movie to sympathize with a villain character, then you have to make sure that there's a mustachio-twirling villain that stays in the story.
Yeah.
In this case, that would, I would say arguably that would be Walton Goggins' character. He's the shady underworld, like arms dealer, whatever, who I think actually that character could be entirely deleted from this story.
Yes.
And the story, like, and all of his goons and everything, like the only thing that really worked about that character was Michael Peña and what happened in that dynamic, which we're not going to spoil because it's a good surprise and it's fun.
Yeah.
But the scene where that character and his lackeys are with Michael Peña is the only, to me, the only redeemable moment for them. And that's not Walton Goggins' fault. It's not Peyton Reed's fault. It's sort of like, okay, that seems like a studio executive directive that, like, if you're going to make the super-powered villain, Ghost, relatable and sympathetic, then you've got to have somebody who's just bad that you can just root against the whole time and feel okay about it.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was Walton Goggins' character and his cronies.
I completely 100% agree with that, because of the fact that Walton Goggins is a great actor. But for him to be placed into this throwaway position where he's just there to establish, as Chad is mentioning, a true foil, somebody you can really just despise in the film, so that you don't have all your anger towards the current focused antagonist, but you can actually have somebody to say, okay, it makes sense. It's logical to not like him because he's just a jerk and he's just that. And I think that's kind of a throwaway, you know, opportunity for somebody of his caliber easily. Because like you said, I honestly felt like any scene that he was a part of, number one, could have been easily replaced with any lesser known actor.
Sure.
And, or secondly, it could have been just entirely removed and worked around for the current situation that was going on.
Yeah. Mainly that second one. I mean, like this story could have been so much leaner and even more straightforward if you did not have him always around. Like,
yeah. It was super,
especially
weird.
By the end, you have so much that you have to tie together by the end of this film that it's like, why did you do this to yourselves?
Yeah.
You didn't have to have it be that complex. It would have been great if you had like two fewer things to track, mainly Walton Goggins and the FBI. Nothing against, I would not want to lose Randall Park.
Oh no,
in this
Randall
film.
Is
no.
amazing.
He was fantastic.
He was the
there
sleeper.
Are other FBI characters that I could have done without. Like, that was a dynamic that was only there because they overcomplicated the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, each time like Walter Goggins came back, I'm like, you're still in this movie?
Yes.
Because after the first scene, I was like, that's weird that he's like in this character role, but he just kept coming back.
Yeah.
It was odd.
Yeah, I agree. And it's one of those things where I do believe, I have to agree with Chad, I do think it was one of those like studio decisions, the executive decision to say, okay, if we're going to do this, we need to have that balance and we're going to have to put this person in there just to have somebody to root for to get caught and blah, blah, blah. But it does give a sense of chaos to the film in terms of, there's no need for somebody like that. I'm hoping, as a Marvel fan, somebody who's coming to see this film, I'm hoping that there's reasons why there's importance played on this particular character.
Right.
Because you don't want to insult the intelligence of moviegoers.
You
first
don't
and foremost.
Want to insult your audience. For sure.
And one thing that has constantly been consistent for Marvel films is you have to pay attention to the small details because of the fact that those small details will come back around and make an appearance somewhere else. This was one of those instances where, like, you're watching and you're like, wow, I wonder who Walton Goggins is going to be. I wonder what his role is going to be in the whole grand scheme of things. I wonder, oh, no, he got arrested. Or, oh, he's doing this. Or, oh, no, he's doing that. It's like none of the things he did made any impact in the overall grand scheme of the film, nor did it impact the actual franchise itself.
And honestly, if they had him in there as a sleeper character to, you know, blossom into some supervillain later on or whatever, I don't care. Mm-hmm. Like, I was never given any reason to care about that character. Mm-hmm. Even, like, thematically, he and his cronies are window dressing at best, and they keep getting in the way of the flow of the story. But again, I think that is a bit the studio exec effect, which is this is a little brighter, funnier, more family friendly. So we've got to have a for sure bad guy, even if they're not the main villain, like somebody that you just, it's okay to root against them, and you're right to root against them. They never turn things around. But like at the same time, in this case, they never matter.
No, not at all.
They just distract.
Yeah. 100%.
So, and there's plenty going on in this story that is worth not being distracted from. I mean, they're constantly like Ghost. What she can do is she can like phase in between planes of reality. She's there. She's not there. She's there. She's not there. Ant-Man and Wasp are changing size all the time. They're making other things around them change size all the time. Like there's visually speaking, there's a lot of visual dynamic.
Yeah.
Shifts that are happening. You don't need this extra story. It's just weighing things down and slowing it down because then you have to tie it up by the end. You introduced it. So you've got to wrap it up somehow. And it's like, okay, for a punchline of a joke, you wasted 15 minutes of screen time for one like joke at the end.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. But I do want to jump on something that you did mention in terms of the visuals. I'm not one to just be focused on CGI, and obviously you can't shrink or grow somebody without having to use CGI. You know, there's not really a practical way to do that.
Well, I mean, you got a little bit of like Gandalf and the Hobbits, right? They had him standing on different levels, and you get a little bit, but there was some enhancement there too.
But I did really enjoy the usage of it in this particular film, especially when they're testing out some of the newer equipment in the film. So there comes a point in the film where they're trying out new suits because apparently the older ones got destroyed. And so they're trying to use the regulators, and it's hilarious because it's like, it's almost like slapstick comedy.
That's exactly
CGI.
What it is. And that's exactly what it is.
It's so great the way they use it and the way it incorporates into the entire story. It's not just like a one-off where like, oh, that scene was funny, but we never revisit that situation again. That situation occurs from the very beginning through all the way to the end, and it's something that you can... It's the running joke through the entire film.
Sure.
And, yeah, I think that was one of the things that I was enjoying focusing on. That was another thing, mind you, that was also kind of very Disney-esque. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. I thought it was great. I thought it had a fun allure to it. Watching Paul Rudd go from, you know, his normal height of 5-whatever or 6-whatever to being like 3 feet tall and looking like a toddler. Like, it was great. All that stuff
was really fun.
So were there any other standout scenes for you guys? Anything that you guys really... enjoyed or things that you'd like to highlight, Spencer?
No.
I think I broke Spencer.
No, I was thinking. I was trying to think you know, if there was something that really stood out to me. And no, I think we've talked about all the ones that, you know, I found super enjoyable.
What about you, Joe?
Oh, I've got so much.
By all means.
Okay, so the Quantum Realm.
Ah, that's right.
AKA Doctor Strange's Playground. So the visuals, I mean, obviously we've already seen some parallelism in the way that it was displayed in the first Ant-Man, and then the way that you see Doctor Strange and Wong and the Ancient One and whomever manipulating realities and dimensions and whatever in Doctor Strange, and even, you know, Doctor Strange and Wong do it in Infinity War. But it was very fun and validating to see that several of the sequences involving the Quantum Realm and the transition between our level of reality and the subatomic level. They're very deliberately displayed as, oh, you saw this in Doctor Strange. Like, there's...
Yeah, oh, yeah.
There's a very, very obvious connection between all of this. And so I enjoyed that. I thought that, again, the Walton Goggins dynamic and everything there, like, it literally ate up 15 minutes or more of screen time.
Yeah.
To no effect. Versus if we had spent a little more time in the quantum realm, if we had spent a little more time... I mean, you really don't... you don't see a whole lot of Michelle Pfeiffer in this movie. Mm-mm. She's important. You do see her. You see some of her before she shrinks down into this, you know, this state of reality. You see her as she is, you know, 30 years later, which is the current time frame for the characters.
Which, by the way, that woman does not look like she's
actually
aged.
Let's talk about her for a second, since we brought up that she's in this movie. She's been gone for 30 years and it looks like she still has makeup on.
You know what?
I was like, where are you getting that from?
You know
from,
what?
Michelle?
Here's the
Where's
thing.
The makeup store?
Here's the thing. Michelle Pfeiffer.
You don't know what's down there.
That could have been a Sephora on the corner. You didn't even see.
Sephora in the quarter realm.
No, that woman has aged so beautifully. Like,
she looks great.
She looks incredible. They obviously, at the beginning of the film, there's a flashback sequence to right before the events that happened in the first Ant-Man film that they describe about the missile incident and she going subatomic. So they show that sequence right before they leave, and I'm looking at her. I'm like, did they de-age her? She looks the same. Like, they colored her hair. Okay, I mean, cool.
Right.
But like, and then obviously you see her later on down the film, and I'm like, yeah, she looks just like at the beginning of the movie. That woman is phenomenal. I want to like make sure my skin looks as nice as hers. Not now, maybe later. But I'm not gonna. But yeah, she just looks phenomenal.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, and it's interesting knowing Janet Van Dyne from the comics.
Yeah,
this is not that character. Like, what I'm excited about as a comic book fan and a Marvel Comics fan in particular is the potential of a character like Janet Van Dyne, who is, she's a different Janet Van Dyne than you've ever seen. So,
oh, 100%.
She's a complete wild card, and I want to see more of her tomorrow. but, you know, we've got time before more movies come out.
Yeah.
I'm assuming she's not going to be in Captain Marvel because that takes place in the 90s. During which time she would have been in the quantum realm for a couple decade or a decade and a half or something by that point. I don't know the exact timing, but you know, so, but it was great to see that they've really constructed an interesting wild card character here.
Yeah.
I mean, when you finally see the aged version of her, there are a lot of question marks.
Oh, 100%.
Especially given what she says to the one who finds her, like how she describes her own like awareness of reality, her own state of being. Like, 30 years is a long time, and this place is apparently very trippy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And has changed her like core makeup of what she is. And you see a bit of a display of that at some point, you know, near the end of the film. But like, I can't wait to see more of, okay, so who did they bring back?
Yeah.
Because she's clearly the same, but different.
Yeah. 100%. I completely agree.
And we don't have a baseline for what that means.
Any thoughts on where the next film, which is going to be
Captain Marvel. Yeah.
Any ideas or any thoughts, maybe any, I don't know, hypotheses in terms of where that's going to fit in terms of the situation at large and her involvement with what's to come? Any thoughts? Since this is essentially the follow-up film to this, not in the timeline-wise, but the follow-up film, which is going to be right before the next Infinity War film, Avengers film.
Well, I would say it's an origin. It has to be an origin story. Mm-hmm. They are about to debut an incredibly powerful, influential, charismatic primary character that we haven't seen yet. So, who will be a primary character for a decade probably to come. So, good on you, Brie Larson, for getting that role, because you're set for life. It's going to be an origin story, but it again, they've said that it takes place primarily, if not all the way, in the 90s.
Yeah.
So it's an era that we haven't seen yet. It's kind of a question mark phase, if you will.
Yeah.
In terms of the history of the Marvel Universe. But as this film points out in some really elegant ways, there's a lot that we don't know about the characters we've already met. You know, the past between Hank Pym and Bill Foster. You kind of scratch the surface on it here. You could make probably a whole TV series about it.
True.
You know, the adventures of a younger Janet Van Dyne in the quantum realm. Like, she went subatomic and she was there for 30 years.
Yeah.
You could do all kinds of things with that.
It's almost like
wanted to.
It's almost like an Obi-Wan in the desert kind of feeling here that you get with essentially this character. When you come to find her and you do essentially see her when whomever is looking for her finds her.
I will say, one of the things that I really appreciated about this film is, as much as this is a continuation of a movie called Ant-Man and borrows quite a lot from Civil War in terms of like the setup of the film.
Yeah.
This is a dual billing film.
Oh,
this is
easily.
Ant-Man and the Wasp. This is very much an origin story for the Wasp, like a continuing origin. You met her already before.
Yeah.
But the first scene that you see is her childhood. So it really is, in a way, it's more her story than his.
Yeah.
Especially when you talk about the theatrics of how they exhibit powers, because she has far more control over what she can do. She has wings. She has blasters. She's just super cool. She's not confused about whether or not she should do this. She's got a very clear kind of mission and purpose. So I think in a way, like we've now finally seen a real origin story of a female superhero character in a Marvel film.
That's a good
You've
point.
You've gotten a little bit with Gamora, I would say. After Infinity War, you got a bit more for Gamora.
Yeah.
To kind of establish that. But, like, this is clearly completing the origin of the Wasp. The young the Wasp, not her mother.
Yeah.
Because you know next to nothing about her still.
Version 2.
But, and then now their next film is the debut of one of their primary characters, male or female, doesn't matter. Captain Marvel bears the name of the company. Hello.
Yeah.
So it's a prime character and she's female and it's an origin story and it's given its own sandbox entirely to play in. Time-wise and canvas-wise, they're using alien races we haven't seen yet. Her story is very cosmic. I think that this is a really nice setup in that regard because there's a lot of like setting up a female superhero and just a lot of like, again, father-daughter dynamics. Cassie eventually becomes a superhero. Cassie Lang down the road, right? Ava, because she's now a sympathetic character, she's a well-rounded villain, antagonist. Somewhere down the road, she could become a superhero.
Oh, yeah, completely.
In the comics, they do it all the time. They switch back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got a lot of really positive, like, the origin of what does power and wielding power look like from a feminine perspective that's different than the masculine perspective that has dominated the conversation up to this point. You get a lot of that here.
Yeah.
In a very kind of tandem environment.
Mm.
And then now your next movie is Captain Marvel, which is not a tandem environment. Like, it's her story.
Man, Chad's starting a whole new conversation right now. No, but it's true. Like, you're really, like, hitting it on the head in terms of where now the direction, the pivot is here now in terms of the direction of where the focus this franchise has been completely on for the last, like we said, for the last decade. And now it's jumping over and investing every single chip that they have in the hopes that people recognize the same kind of power and skill sets and abilities, and even more so with what is to come in our new heroes, such as, you know, Hope Van Dyne's Wasp, as well as Captain Marvel with Brie Larson.
Don't even Carol let Danvers. Me get started again on Okoye. And I will go for a year. Okoye forever.
So,
honestly, like, in terms of, like, natural gravitas, power, strength, beauty, valor, honor, like, that's this whole thing started with Black Panther.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of that. And then obviously you've got some definite nuances throughout Infinity War, especially with Gamora, and now you've got the Wasp, and everything is leading up to Captain Marvel's debut, but also that leads into what comes next. Kevin Feige has been very verbose recently about, yep, female stars, female directors, like, the future is female.
Yeah. Oh, completely.
For the MCU. Absolutely.
Yeah. Before we wrap this up, any complaints, any issues with the films before we...
I think we've gone through most of my issues.
It all got covered.
Cool.
In a way. Without spoiling anything.
What about you, Eddie? You have any issues with this film?
Oh, no. I've already stated everything that I got issues with.
Yeah, Paul Rudd's face. That's what...
Pretty much it. Wow. No, there was a couple things we had actually touched on. Just so you know, there is a mid-credit scene and an end-credit scene. We're not going to talk about what they are, but so that you know to stay in your seat when the credits roll, because people always make that mistake.
Your questions will be answered.
With that said, let's go ahead and go around the table, start with Spencer. Does it pass or fail, and how many monocles?
Yeah, this movie definitely passes for me, and I will give it a 4. It was really good.
There you go.
I completely agree. I'm going to pass it and give it 4. I think... A star and a half is Evangeline Lilly as the Wasp. You can tell.
Yeah.
You can tell that she's enjoying herself.
Oh, 100%.
So, yeah, definitely. Eddie?
As for myself, it does pass, and I'm giving it a 3.5. I enjoyed the film. I thought it was great. There was a little bit of the issues and the missteps with Walton Goggins' character.
Absolutely.
And Paul Rudd is still Paul Rudd. So, with that said... I'm going to give it a 3.5, which is an improvement. I'm not too sure what I gave it last time when we reviewed Ant-Man, but I don't think it was as high. So,
probably not.
But that about wraps up another awesome episode. Remember, if you get a chance, check out the film this weekend. It debuts this Friday in your local theater, so check out your local listings. Before we go, we want to let you know that this episode drops on 4th of July. So if you were hearing this the day it drops, happy 4th of July. Be safe, be fun. Check out a great patriotic film.
Don't start any fires.
There's already one started out here in California, so, and just have fun. I mean, watch a great patriotic film on us, so we hope you have fun.
That's right, and we love America.
There you go. As we said, this was a great episode. If you want to check out other episodes, check out our website at filmlosophers.com, or our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers, or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. So here's to hoping that this film really does break that glass ceiling with a lot of what we were just talking about in terms of female strong roles, and continues that, you know, that motivation and that
the momentum is there, and it's in their favor. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And I would say even looking at something like Wonder Woman, yeah, it's the other brand. That's working in their favor too, because that was a phenomenal movie, and everything in the past, what, year and a half to 2 years, has been underscoring the need for stories like these.
Yeah, easily. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Have a great 4th of July, and class dismissed.